Welcome to the Memories of a Moonbird podcast, exploring life one story at a time. Hello, friends. Today on the show, she has no shortage of courage and adrenaline. If rock climbing, base jumping, skydiving, and a plethora of other adventures weren't enough, this adventurer is also a best-selling author, entrepreneur, and public speaker. Her first book, Journey of Heart, told the story of losing her father and brother to an avalanche on Pakistan's tallest mountain, K2, and her journey back there to try and recover their remains. Her second book, Changing Gears, Ups and Downs on the New Zealand Road, is the story of her soul-searching 28-day solo cycle across both of New Zealand's islands. Later this year, she'll be releasing her third book, Dream of Flight, a detailed look at her journey literally learning to fly using a wingsuit. In addition to her literary success, she started a nonprofit organization to support the creative needs of children called the Denali Foundation, named after her brother. Adventurer, entrepreneur, author, and so much more, please welcome the incredible Sequoia Schmidt. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Pleasure to meet you. So tell me, I'm curious, what was it like growing up in New Zealand?
Yeah, that's a good starter question. It's honestly one of the most beautiful places on the planet. Really, there's no place in the world that I can compare to it. It's absolutely beautiful. Just culturally, it's awesome to grow up there. Like, I would want to raise my kids there. It's just such great culture.
Yeah, we went there for our 10-year anniversary, and we're going to talk about that because I wanted to know if you've done the Black Abyss tour from the legendary Blackwater Adventure Company in Waitomo.
Yeah, no, I haven't. I've heard of it, but I haven't done it.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's a 3-hour underground caving tour, and it's everything you love.
That sounds sick. Yeah, I like, it's funny because it's the same thing with LA, right? Like, I've lived in LA for about 6 years, maybe 7 years. And I've never, ever done one of those like jump on the bus Hollywood tours. Like, it's so funny. You live somewhere and you're from somewhere and you just don't do the things that most people who go to that place to do. So the same thing with New Zealand. Like, I never did the Hobbiton tour, which is like a huge tour in New Zealand that a lot of people.
It's awesome.
Is it? Did you do it? You did all touristy things, didn't you?
We did. Well, we did some off the beaten path stuff, but the Hobbiton tour, we happened to be there on like Bilbo Baggins' birthday.
Cool. Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, it was really cool. When did you first get into climbing and adventure sports?
I mean, I grew up around it just because my dad was a mountaineer. He was a professional mountain guide. So his, you know, his job was to take people up some of the tallest mountains in the world, Aconcagua, Everest, Chaloyu, and was gone about, you know, 9 months of the year climbing on some of the big Himalayan peaks and mountains in, you know, South America and all over the world. And so we grew up around that. I mean, I could climb before I could walk pretty much. we're always encouraged to do that. And the beauty about growing up in New Zealand is that, you know, there's a lot more cultivation of the imagination in terms of like running around barefoot in the backyard. And yeah. I just felt like there was such an opportunity for imaginative growth when I was growing up there. And during the time when I was younger, he would, you know, drag me on climbs and stuff. And I think I was 8 years old when I did Whitney for the first time.
Wow.
I remember complaining the entire way up. And now I look back on it and I'm like, oh my God, I'm so glad he made me do that.
Well, I'm curious, what took you from New Zealand to Los Angeles?
I moved to the States right, like literally a month before my 16th birthday, and lived with my grandfather there. And then I got into publishing. I was a publisher long before I was a writer.
This is D'Angelo?
D'Angelo Publication.
And this is your company?
It is, yeah. Yeah, I started really young. I was like 16.
I'm curious, what made you want to start a publishing company? Because that's not some, most 16-year-olds want to go to the mall, you know?
I think I just always knew I wanted to work for myself. I was good in school, but I wasn't a classroom student, if that makes any sense. I learned a little bit differently than most students. And I guess I was always pretty motivated. And I knew I didn't really want to take a traditional route. You know, New Zealand's really big on vocational education versus preparatory. And the U.S. is all about preparatory education. And when I was leaving New Zealand, even a lot of my friends who were in their mid-teens were already starting to look at doing apprenticeships and going into the vocational route. And America, that's like not even discussed. If you're 15, you don't even think about becoming a plumber.
Right.
So for me, when we were coming out of high school, I did 1 year in high school in Texas. And everyone who was coming out of high school was going straight into college. And I just kind of knew I didn't want to take a traditional route. I knew that I wanted to work for myself. I always kind of had planned on working for myself. And the publishing company, it started as a magazine publishing company. It started with one magazine called HY.
What was it about?
It was like Houston Youth, and it failed miserably. But I kept it around for like I think 3 years. And I look back on it just like entrepreneurially now that I'm older and I'm like, wow, you cut that a lot longer than you should have.
I'm curious because we both rock climb and obviously you're an amazing climber. What's the highest rated climb you've done? And do you
I'm have not even like that big of a rock climber. It's so funny because I like when I left New Zealand and went and lived in Texas and went into business, I like literally left everything adventure related, rebelled against everything like my climbing father stood for, you know. So I didn't touch climbing again until I was like 23. Wow. And so I had like a good 6, 7, 8 year gap from that, and just kind of rebelled against everything that stood for and preferred to have nice nails and wear high heels and be in a business suit.
And how do you feel about the nice nails and the climbing now? Do you like both?
I guess my nails are all right now, but I'm down on one. So yeah, I mean, I like both. I think I just, you know, I went back towards, and that's kind of like what my first book's about, I guess, was that journey that I took. So my father and brother were killed in 2013 on K2. And then I went back to Pakistan in 2015. And I went into Pakistan and went through kind of like a soul searching journey and went into K2.
And that was about a month, right? A month long journey?
Yeah, it was about a month of no shower.
Yeah.
But like, that was, I think, a huge turning point where I decided, okay, I would like to like really kind of figure out who I am in my own right, in the world of adventure. And I started climbing again and got into rock a little bit, got into ice a little bit, mountaineering and alpinism. I rock climb. I like it. I enjoy it. I'm not a great rock climber, but I enjoy it. I mean,
do you have any aspirations to conquer any kind of particular climb or hike or wingsuit jump, which we're going to talk about in a little bit?
Yeah. So I tried, there was this beautiful mountain in the Himalayas called Amma de Blom. And, I was on Amma de Blom, or I was heading to Amma de Blom. We were trying to do a double ascent of a mountain called La Buche East, and La Buche East is like kind of like a warm up. And so like, I was going up there to try to warm up for Amma de Blom and see how I could do on that. And I got HACE, which is high altitude cerebral edema, 3 years ago. So it's really impacted my ability to go to altitude.
What are the symptoms of that? I'm just curious.
So it varies person to person. For me, the first symptoms was a headache, which is pretty normal at altitude. Most people get a headache at one point or another in altitude. And then I felt a little bit dizzy. And then the next few symptoms, I couldn't figure out myself because I thought I was completely fine, but unsteady walking, slurred speech, and then goes into projectile vomiting, blurred vision.
It's like having a stroke.
Yeah, I guess. So it's cerebral edema is where the brain starts swelling inside your head. So it can be really, really dangerous.
Yeah.
So for me, I didn't realize the symptoms. It was actually my climbing partner at the time who realized them. He was like, are you okay? You don't look so good. Very moody and emotional. That's like, you know, a classic sign that you're starting to get haste. You're not acting yourself. Like I was really angry. I like snapped one of my tent poles in half when we were setting up camp.
Wow.
Yeah. And so I didn't even notice it. And he was like, hey, walk towards me. And he noticed I was like, wasn't really walking straight. And then he noticed my speech was slurred. And so to me, when I'm saying something like, I'm fine. It's like, bleh. And then when my vision started going blurry and when I started projectile vomiting, I was like, oh shit, this is serious.
So I assume they rushed you off the mountain at that point.
They was just me and my climbing partner. We weren't the guide or anything. So it was just us two doing an ascent together. So he was like, hey, we got to get down. I clipped in. They have preset ropes on La Buche. Depending on your climbing style, you can choose to use them or not. And I clipped into the preset rope and just started going down really, really quick to get myself out of there.
And how long did it take until you started feeling better?
When I got back to the camp below that, I took what's called dexamethasone, which is a drug that helps with that situation. And then I took some anti-nausea pills. And because I'm ridiculously stubborn and I never suggest this to anyone, I wanted to go back up the next day, which I should have never done. And of course, I made it like 150 meters and the same thing happened. So I had to go down and get helied out.
And at what elevation was that happening?
So my trigger point on that was like 5,600 meters around that.
Oh, that's crazy.
Yeah. So that's unfortunate. So it's kind of like, I really wanted to do Amma de Blom. I've been wanting to do it for years. To me, it's one of the most beautiful mountains in the world. It's kind of like the Matterhorn of Nepal. And my dad summited it quite a few times, and it's just a stunning mountain. And I don't know if I'll ever have the chance to get up it, just because it's kind of, the haze situation has kind of been really debilitating. Now it's like triggered me to get really bad migraines constantly.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. So it's just been something I'm kind of working through with my doctor and trying to figure it out. But to answer your question, I'm Mont Blanc for sure.
Okay.
You should Google this mountain. It's like the most beautiful mountain.
Well, if you don't mind, I'd like to ask you about your dad and brother. I actually lost my father a year and a half ago. And so I understand some of that pain. Yeah, thanks. And I know it's been 7 years since you lost your dad and brother.
Oh God. I thought it was six, but you're right. It's been seven.
I know the time. I can't believe it's been a year and a half. I feel like it was yesterday. But I'm curious, one, how are things for you now? And I'm really curious if you felt a sense of closure when you got back from
K2. Yeah. I hate that word.
I do too, because I think it's bullshit. I don't think you ever have closure.
Yeah, I've never liked closure. I like go on a rant about it in my first book. The reader's going to get so bored listening to this. But yeah, I mean, I don't think you can, with grief, with the process of grief, I don't think there is ever such thing as closure. I think that you're able to adapt to a life without that person in it mm-hmm. over time. But there's nothing that, to me, closure implies that period is closed. And I don't think that, at least for me personally, I don't think that will ever be closed. It's something that I move on from and I live with, but it's not something that's a closed section of my life. So to answer your question, closure in the traditional form, no, not at all. Closure in the, I guess, the metaphorical form, then yes, it's allowed me to process aspects of grief that I wouldn't have been able to process if I didn't take that journey to K2. That was a huge part of opening me up to a whole new world. As I said before, like the world I was in before my dad and brother passed away was literally, I had an office, I'd go to it every day. I was charge hard, young entrepreneur, and it completely adjusted everything. I changed my company structure to allow me to travel, to allow my employees to work remotely. Like during this COVID thing, it's so funny to me where all these companies are like having their employees work remotely. I've been a remote company for 7-8 years now. 7 years.
I've been one for 18 years.
Yeah. And that, like, that's for me, I was like, you know, that was a huge part of when I got back from Pakistan. I changed a lot in my life. I started opening up to Mother Nature in a way I never had before, to adventure, to mountaineering, to climbing, to pretty much anything that I had previously been afraid of, I guess would be a good way to say it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you talk about restructuring the company, and I think you'll agree, I also restructured part of my life. And I one thing I tell people is that I stopped suffering anyone who wasted my time. And I politely escorted a few people out of my life who didn't need to be there. And, you know, just your priorities shift incredibly when you go through that kind of a loss. And but I'm very curious, because I've been going through some things on my own. How do you think overall, or I should say, what is something in particular that you think changed who you are today that you really are glad of from the experience?
Oh, I mean, hands, like, I think that there's so many things that, and it's so weird to say this, but it's something that I think about constantly, is like my greatest tragedy in life, my greatest tragedy that will ever happen in my life, was also like the greatest blessing in my life, because it allowed me to kind of open my eyes and realize that, hey, this life is really fucking short and you should be able to experience and taste and smell and fucking feel every emotion that you possibly can in a short period of time that we have on this earth.
Yeah.
And I think that that's something that some people are lucky enough to find on their own, and other people like me have to be faced with a really traumatic event to come to that realization and change the way they operate in day-to-day lives. Because grief is, you know, it's something we're all going to experience at some point or another in our lives. Mm-hmm. Like every human being is going to lose someone in their life or something, you know. And it's something that, as common as it is, it's still not openly discussed like a lot of other topics are.
And I wish we would. I wish we would talk about grief more so people understood it wasn't so taboo. It's so ridiculous that it is that way, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Do you, so my dad was a big chocolate lover, and every year on his birthday, we all, my family and I get together, we all have chocolate and stuff like that. Is there something cool that you guys do to honor your dad and brother?
Yeah. I mean, for me personally, it's just like every time I'm in the mountains, that's pretty much it. Mm. Yeah. Anytime I'm in like the mountains or Mother Nature or doing something that I know they would consider super rad, that's definitely a way that I feel like I connect with them.
If, you know, we could have Star Trek magic and you could go back in time or magically have them appear now, what do you think you would say to them both?
I mean, I'd probably just like reiterate how, oh, I don't think I even reiterate. I think I'd just tell them how important they were in my life, because I don't think I ever did that. Mm. You know, I don't think I, and like, that's something that I carry with me. Talk about change. Like, that's something I overly tell my fiance how much he means to me in my life. Like, now I'm like, because I know what it's like to lose somebody before being able to express certain things, now I'm very adamant about expressing every emotion that I have towards people.
Well, I know I'm a total stranger, but I really do believe they know. I really do, you know. Yeah. Not to be all LA about this, but have you ever thought about making your story into a movie? Because it's pretty incredible.
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, it was the book was optioned 3 years ago by a company out of London, and then it just got like the script just got finished on it a little while ago, and it's
great.
Really optioned now, so, yeah. I mean, I don't know, like LA is so.
I know.
If it happens, cool. I'm okay with that, just because I feel like there's a pretty powerful story in there for other people who, you know, who, like I said, I had to go through something pretty traumatic to realize the life that I was capable of living. And ideally, other people can learn from that and not have to go through such a traumatic thing to realize that.
Yeah, I agree. Well, hey, I want to ask you about your forthcoming book and about base jumping. And for listeners who don't know, base jumping stands for building antenna span and earth. It's the
four main places. Wow, good job. Most people don't get that. That's awesome.
I know my stuff. And it's the things that someone can essentially jump off of. So I'd love you to tell us how you got into it. How did you learn how to fly? What's it like wearing a wingsuit? I have a bunch of questions about it. So please.
Are you going to nerd out on me right now?
Yes.
I'll nerd out on myself.
I have wanted to put on a wingsuit and fly since I first discovered them, and I'm not going to do it because it scares the shit out of me, but I'd love to hear what it's like.
So that's why, to answer your question, that's why I chose to kind of venture into the world of human flight, was because it scared the shit out of me. And so since Pakistan, right, like when I went to Pakistan, I went by myself through Pakistan into K2, and like, the amount of people who were telling me I was going to get raped, murdered, kidnapped by Taliban. Like, when I went there, I was super afraid when I first got there. And then after that experience of, you know, getting to know some of the Pakistani locals in that region and spending a lot of time in this beautiful Karakoram mountain range and coming out of the whole experience and thinking to myself, wow, I was terrified of that. And it ended up being one of the most amazing experiences of my life. Mm. That could just kind of propelled me into a world of finding something I'm really afraid of and going hardcore at it. I was terrible at biking. I've always been a terrible biker. I went biking with my friends one time in California and I was just like really slow and awful. So the next thing was like, oh, I haven't been to New Zealand in a while. Maybe I'll cycle around the country. Sounds super scary and intimidating to me. So maybe I'll try that.
I'll bet it was awesome.
It was. It was like seriously awesome. It was freaking epic adventure with a lot of hills. And that my life over the last 6 odd 7 years has really been about kind of finding the things that scare me and terrify me and exposing myself to them and putting myself in them and seeing what I'm physically, mentally, and emotionally capable of, because I think through those challenges is where you grow the most as a human being. And that's something that attracted me immediately was human flight.
Wait, so I'm just curious, how high are you on the average base jump? And does the chute come out immediately or is there a free fall before you pull?
It's up to you, really. If you're going what's called stowed, where the pilot chute is inside of the container, then you can hold, you know, a solid 1 second, 2 seconds, 3 seconds, depending on how high you are. And before you pitch. And then once you pitch, it does come out immediately. It's a really fast open. So one of the main things that's a difference between skydiving and base jumping, apart from base jumping being fixed object jumping, you're actually jumping off of something fixed, is also the equipment style, right? So with skydiving, you have a main canopy and you have a reserve in case something goes wrong. With base jumping, you just have one canopy. Yeah, I mean, I think that base jumping is something that you really have to want to get into. It takes a lot of time, a lot of dedication. I had a really low number of skydives before I started base. 250 is a low number of skydives. I think that's too late until 300, 400 skydives. And that's, you know, you're talking about tens of thousands of dollars in equipment and jumps and energy and time. And it's a lot. Yeah. You have to be really dedicated.
I went skydiving 20 years ago.
Oh, cool.
And it was awesome. But I actually like hang gliding better than skydiving.
Yeah, hang gliding is cool too.
You know, you're up in the air for so long.
Skydiving is actually, you don't realize how much you're actually in the air and how much altitude you've actually got until you are, I mean, it took me like 100 jumps until I realized like, holy crap, I've got a lot of time up here. Like you've got sometimes 3 minutes. Like if you're on a long wingsuit jump, if you're a really good wingsuiter, it's a lot of time up there compared to something like base where you've got seconds.
Tell the listeners what it's like to be in a wingsuit and step out of a plane and fly. I'd love to hear it. Describe it if you can.
It's a tough one to describe. I think it's like a very personal experience. I feel like, because it's not just the actual flight itself. It's everything that led up to that flight. Right. So, I remember my first flight very vividly. I was fucking terrified. Anytime you do anything new, it doesn't matter if you've got like a couple hundred skydives or whatever it is. Anytime you do anything new, anytime you step out of that comfort zone, especially in air sports, it just fucking throws you, right? So
yeah.
I remember my first flight, it was at Paris, which is just down from LA. It's 2 hours down from LA. That's where I jumped. And I was with a good buddy of mine. Funnily enough, the same guy who was there when I did my very first base jump in Tonsai. He was training me on wingsuit for my very first jump. And yeah, I was fucking shitting myself. I was terrified. So I zip up the suit and put on my helmet and I like just look at him. I'm just like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. And so one thing that's really important when you're exiting a plane, when you've got a big wingsuit on, you can't exit like this or else the wind will just blow you back and you might hit the back of the plane, right? Eesh. So when you exit the plane, you have to stay in a ball like this and then you slowly come out into your wingsuit before you start flying. So we're crawling up to the edge of the plane and I'm like standing right there and he's like, okay, whatever you do, stay in a ball before you open up. And so like, all I'm thinking is stay in a ball, stay in a ball, stay in a ball. And instead of actually like jumping out and like staying in a ball, I just kind of like fall off the side. I'm in a ball and I'm like, oh, wait a minute. I've been in a ball for too long and the plane's gone. Maybe I should open up now. And then I go,
that's hilarious.
And I'm on my back. And I'm like, oh my God, where's the ground? I don't know where I am. And you're just kind of floating around like this. And I was like, wow. I don't know where I am. I don't know where I am. And then what I did was I flipped my head back and it allowed me to rotate over. So then I was in full flight. And full flight was pretty freaking unbelievable. And I have a few more jumps since then. So I've gotten used to it a little bit more. But I remember that.
Is it cold?
I mean, it depends what time of year. I was jumping, last time I was jumping Paris and it's pretty warm. If anything, it's a little bit hot. And then once you're flying, I don't even notice temperature when I'm flying because I'm concentrating on that.
So how do you maneuver?
So every little tiny, and that's something that I learned on my first jump right away, was that every little tiny movement of the head, of the neck, of the shoulders, of the hands, everything, your hips, adjusts your flying pattern, right?
Wow.
So you just tilt like this and suddenly you go, whew, tilt like this and so, whoo. But you realize it really quickly. You
must have a mad respect for birds doing this.
Yeah, that's something that like, I think it was, I don't know, jump. Once I wasn't totally pissing myself by jump like 10, I was like, oh, okay, this is how it's supposed to feel. And once I started going out, like, you know, you have certain movements to go a little bit faster and increase your what's called angle of attack. Once I started learning that stuff a little bit more, and I'm still learning that stuff, that then it gets really fun. Then you're like, whoa, this is aerodynamics. Holy crap. This is a whole new level. And that's definitely like, if I had to categorize one of the coolest things I've ever done in my life, wingsuiting is one of the coolest things I've ever done.
Well, tell us about Dream of Flight. So you wrote a book about this.
Yeah, it was just kind of, so when I started the skydiving process, a friend of mine who runs a magazine called Adventure Sports Journal in California, He was like, hey, do you want to write a column about what it's like to get your A license in skydiving? So I started it as a column and then I just kept writing because I was, you know, whenever I'm inspired or I'm going through an interesting situation, I always like to write about it. So I just started writing more and more and just the kind of the emotional ups and downs. There's a lot of technical literature out there if you're searching for it on human flight. There's not a lot of emotional literature and just kind of what it's like to go through this journey of figuring out everything relating to human flight. And that's not just wingsuiting. It's not just skydiving. It's not just base. Like I started researching and went and did my, you know, my paragliding license, speed flying, went to France and spent 3 weeks speed riding with skis on my speed. So I'd ski a little bit and then take off and then fly a little bit. Speed riding's really fun. But so I just kind of wanted to experience multiple different forms of aerodynamics in human flight and kind of figure out the emotional side of it as well. And once you start to learn one activity in that arena, what is it like to try to parlay into another? So once I know a little bit of canopy skills from regular skydiving, what is it like to then parlay into something like speed riding?
And where do you think all this is headed?
Human flight.
Yeah. Well, human flight and for you personally, do you have any flight goals? And do you think that eventually, you know, like rock climbing has really caught on now and so many more people are rock climbing? When we first started together 20 years ago, people would beg us to take them out.
Yeah.
And now there's rock climbing gyms all over LA. And, you know, so do you think human flight is the next big sport that people are going to start doing?
Yeah. I mean, I think that rock climbing can be incredibly dangerous, especially if you're doing it at the level that a lot of climbers are choosing to pursue. But base is a whole nother fucking game. Base is a whole nother game. And
I'll be honest with you, man, it's hardcore. And I have no desire to do it. I respect you immensely for doing it. I think you are, well, for many reasons, and we're going to talk about that later, you are an inspiration to other women to get out there and kick ass and live life. And, you know, it's really awesome what you do. It's super impressive.
Thank you. I think it's important to note that, like I said, there's a lot of preparation that needs to go into it. And there's been, you know, in the last few years, especially my fiance is a base instructor and so he's really meticulous about.
Is that how you guys met?
People. We met jumping. Yeah. But he's really meticulous about people coming into the sport and learning really the protocol that goes with it. But a lot of people will see it and they'll see wingsuiting, they'll see base jumping and they'll be like, oh, that's awesome. Yeah. I want to go do that. But it's really important to understand what goes into it in order to pursue an activity like this and understand the risks that are involved, especially somebody who's lost someone to an extreme activity. It's very, very, very important that people understand the risks that are involved, not just for themselves. And a lot of people will be like, oh yeah, especially base jumpers, there's a mentality of like, I understand the risks, I'm totally cool if I die. Well, it's not you who's left behind, it's your family who's left.
Yeah, exactly.
And,
exactly.
There's a lot of stupidity when it comes to jumping, and that's something that we're trying to change in the base community. It's just like be really conscious and understand all of the whole situation that you're going into and understand your wind conditions and understand your canopy. And that stuff's super important.
Sequoia, you are an accomplished author and entrepreneur, adventurer. I'm curious if you have other career goals for down the road.
I love publishing. I've had my publishing firm for 12 years. We do about 12 to 15 books a year. And I never, ever thought I was going to be a writer. The first book just kind of flowed. And one of the publishers in my office was like, hey, we should publish this under the firm's name. But there's so many cool aspects to publishing that I'm really enjoying. And a lot of the reason that I live in LA is because my firm has a branch that does subsidiary and film and television rights. So quite a few of our books have been optioned or in development for film and television. And I really love exploring that creative side of it. For me, I think career goal wise, I don't necessarily like set super hard goals in terms of career. I just see what kind of creative people are around me and how we can kind of curate and cultivate really awesome projects.
I'm curious, as an author yourself, what kind of books you like to read?
It depends. I'm a big nonfiction reader. I also like, I'm a huge Lucy Maud Montgomery fan. Do you know who that is?
Yeah, the Canadian author of Anne of Green Gables.
She's been one of my favorite writers since I was wee bitty. And I love how she puts words together.
Is there a particular genre that you're drawn to more than others as a publisher?
I have to be really open-minded. It's really, so for me, I try to be as open-minded as possible. Personally, I really, really enjoy working on children's books. I always have. And I really enjoy working on biographies and memoirs. So biography, autobiography, and memoir, like those, that category is one of my favorites.
Now, do you want to be as big as Random House and be the CEO of this big company?
No. And we're like, we're what's called a modernized publisher. We're a little different from traditional publishers. I mean, don't get me wrong. Traditional publishers are great for what they're doing, but I like to look for stories that may not catch the eye of a traditional publisher. I enjoy staying the size we are. We, you know, there was one year where we did 17 books and I was like, no way. I'd rather stick to 12 to maximum 15 and have those 12 books be like something we're concentrating super hard on. I prefer to be, you know, a smaller publisher and then have branches into the other aspects of creativity, such as the film and television or whatever it may be, then concentrate 100% of our energy just on producing as many books as possible. That's not real.
And I'm curious today, what is the percentage of digital versus actual print?
We do all of ours in both print and digital form. Yeah. So it's really important. And to answer your question, it really depends on the book and it depends on the genre. Mm. Certain genres do, like children's books, do way better on printed version on hardback than they do on an e-reader. But we do all of our books, whether they're illustrated or not, we do them through, you know, obviously the Kindle, iBooks and Nook, as well as the printed editions.
Do you want children yourself?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that would be a road. That's like a whole different journey and adventure, right?
It's a different podcast.
A whole different journey. I'm not quite there yet. I mean, I was, you know, I think I'm part of that generation that is waiting a little later to have kids. I mean, I'm in my late 20s now, so probably in my early 30s.
Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. And, you know, we have talked about, John and I have talked about, like, we have quite a few things that we want to do together before we decide to take that.
You guys adopted Ash and Hazel, the two adorable puppies, which, holy shit, those are cute dogs.
Yeah, they're like part, they're half German Shepherd and half Beagle. Like this guy who has a little farm down the road from us, he had a huge German Shepherd guy and a little Beagle lady. And he like didn't realize she was pregnant. And then he's like, oh, I guess we have puppies. Like, you guys want some puppies? And we went, whenever I was like, babe, let's just go look at one of the puppies.
Oh, that's dangerous.
And it was like, they're sisters. We can't separate them. But yeah, they're so cute. They're such trouble. They're like in the terrible twos, chewing absolutely everything phase. But they're smart as hell.
Well, like, hey, let's talk about life just a little bit. I like to ask some fun, random questions here. How would you feel if your phone was taken away for 6 months and you had no other access to the internet? Would you be fine or would you freak out?
I'd be fine. I'd probably like get a little bit upset in the first few weeks to a month just because that's my contact with my company and my employees. And they, you know, they're pretty self-sufficient. So I think they'd survive. But then, yeah, the thing about climbing and climbing expeditions, like when you go on a climbing expedition, you're without your phone like a good chunk of the time.
Yeah.
It's actually really nice.
It is.
It's beautiful to get away from that and then come back to the real world after and get bombarded with shit.
I grew up without a cell phone. So for me, it's like, this is like my childhood. You know? Yeah, are you hopeful for the future?
That's so crazy to get in the world without a cell phone.
Yeah, I did. I grew up without a cell phone and without a computer.
Nuts.
So I didn't have my first email account until I was 22 or 24.
Really?
Or something like that.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's weird. It makes me think, like, I'm so incredibly fortunate to be in a time where we have access to this stuff. Like in terms of running a company remotely, so fortunate. There's no other time in history that you really could have done the way that I'm running my company. There's no other time. And the same thing with human flight is one thing that like I'm, you know, exploring in the book, is so fortunate to be able to be born into an era where we're so advanced in the technology towards human flight and the wingsuits that we're making and the types of canopies that we're making. And, you know, you bounce back 50 years ago, 100 years ago, and you look at some of the stuff even Leonardo da Vinci was working on, and it's like dreams of flight. And we're actually living in a reality where flying a wingsuit is one of the closest things you would ever get to being a bird.
So cool.
It's pretty amazing.
When does the book come out?
Honestly, it depends on COVID. We'll see how it goes.
Are you hopeful for the future?
That's a very general, broad question. Yes.
Well, no, some people, you know, some people are all doom and gloom and they're like, no, I think we're fucked as a species and this is the end. And some people are like, no, I think humanity will always find a way and we'll, you know, I'm just curious with what you've been through in your life and who you are. If you look to the, what do you think about when you look to the future? Because I'm a pretty optimistic person, honestly.
Yeah. Do you mean in this particular current situation, or you mean just in general?
No, I just mean in general.
Yeah. Super. Yeah. It's a beautiful planet, beautiful world, we're a great species. I mean, we're a little bit fucked up here and there, and we got some stuff to learn. But
so what's one of your favorite movies?
I really, really like What the Bleep Do We Know? Have you ever seen that?
Marley Matlin, isn't it, right?
Yeah, I really like that. I Am Sam. I really like I Am Sam.
What's one of your favorite sounds?
One of my favorite sounds. I really like a babbling brook, like a trickling water sound. That or the sound of a canopy opening.
Favorite smell and favorite food.
Okay, so I really love portobello mushrooms, like grilled portobello mushrooms, and even like putting a little bit of goat cheese inside. And my favorite smell, probably lavender, like fresh lavender peanut.
What do you think as a person in the world you have most to learn in your life right now?
Patience, I'd say. It's a big one for me. I spent a few years ago, 7 days in a silent meditation retreat in Thailand. That was a really good experience to learn patience, because you're kind of forced in that situation to learn patience.
Sounds awesome.
Yeah. And like this situation in COVID, you're having to be patient when you're doing a lot of extreme activities. And the path through human flight was a huge part of that for me. You have to be really, really patient. You have to do your due diligence. You have to really know your shit, or you're going to die. And it forces you to be patient. And that's something that I've had a problem with for a really long time, is my ability to be patient in situations and circumstances. And that's something that I'm continuing to work on. But extreme activities has helped me a lot in that.
If you could sit down with anyone in history, alive or dead, who's not a relative or a friend, for 4 hours in some really cool old pub, who would you want to sit and have a drink with and talk to? What would you drink? And what's the first thing you'd ask them?
So alive or dead?
Alive or dead. Anyone in history except family or friends.
So to make it easier, I'll just say alive. Because dead is a whole nother world. Like, you can go into like anyone in history. That would get really...
I get Jesus a lot. People pick Jesus. They're like, oh, I'd sit with Jesus.
I would want to do Jesus's PR rep. That's what I would do. No, I'm kidding. Alive, I'd probably say Richard Branson in a pub in England. Mm. That would be quite fun.
What would you drink?
I'm not really a big drinker. I'll have a chai tea latte.
Nice.
But no, if I was in a pub with Richard Branson, of course I would have a beer. But yeah, I mean, I've been a huge fan of his for quite a long time. I really like his approach to business.
What's the first thing you'd ask him?
What would I ask Richard Branson? I think I would have a sip of my beer and soak in the moment. And then I would probably ask him something about his business, like something to do with like, once you've accomplished everything you've accomplished, what is the point of it all? What are the core values that have allowed him to raise a family, being at the status and the level that he is, to keep them so grounded?
Great question.
Because that's really, really hard to do.
What's your spirit animal?
Probably an eagle.
And Sequoia Schmidt, what do you think right now, who you are and where you are? What do you think is the meaning of life?
Fuck, you have some deep questions. Oh my God.
It's not a boring, podcast, kid.
And you're like, do you want to see the questions beforehand? I'm like, no, it's a podcast. We're fine. Maybe I should have looked at the questions beforehand. What would I ask Richard Branson? What's the meaning of life? Jesus. Okay. You know, it's so funny because this answer would have changed, you know, 3 years ago, 5 years ago, 7 years ago. I feel like it's constantly evolving and changing. But I would say right now.
I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, right now where I am, I think ultimately love and human connection is in the world. And the reason I say that, a huge part of why I say that, is because, you know, I spent all of my 20s traveling the world along, you know, having insane, awesome experiences and going on these epic adventures. And I think I was in my late 20s and I just kind of realized this is all amazing, but having someone to share it with makes a big difference.
Yeah, I agree completely.
Yeah, having somebody to, like, John and I were talking the other day and he was like, he went to Costco and he got like these macaroons and he's like, oh, this macaroon's good, but it's nothing compared to that one we had in the airport in Geneva
on our way to miss a flight to go to London or whatever, you know, like there's just these super cool experiences that we've shared together. And that's when I look back on my life, I'm like, that's what really matters.
I agree with you completely. So the last thing I do with all of my podcast subjects is I have a little game called 299 Philosophical and Life Questions with Moonbird. And you don't have to answer all 299. You just pick two numbers from my list from 1 to 299. You pick two numbers. Some of the questions are funny. Some of them are serious. But randomly select your two numbers, my friend.
Number one is 27.
27. Okay. What's your second number?
7.
Okay. 27 and 7. Number 27. What kind of parent do you think you'll be?
Interesting. Based off of how I am with the two puppies, I would say I'm going to be the disciplinarian who overcoddles. But what I would say I would strive to be as a parent, I would like to think that I'll be the type of parent who lets the child explore and figure things out on their own and is there as a, you know, a guiding force, but allows them to have their own experiences. It's important.
I think that's the key to being the greatest parent on earth is doing just that. Number 7, what is something you're not good at?
Ooh, I'm really bad at spelling. I'm a terrible,
really?
Which is funny because I'm a,
and you're a publisher. That's hilarious.
Yeah, I know, but that's why I have editors. I am a terrible speller. And I think it's like a third culture kid syndrome because there's this thing called third culture kids where you grow up in multiple different cultures. And I was, you know, I moved 16 times before I was 14 years old and like grew up in 4 different countries. And I think a huge part of that is like, you don't have, yeah, the constant attention of the same teacher. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It just messes with your spelling. There's this group on Facebook called Third Culture Kid that I'm a part of that's really cool. That's just like, you can speak multiple languages, but you can't spell in any of them. when you think of Visa, you don't automatically think of the card. You think of like a passport.
Getting to another country. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, there's like a lot of like little traveler things on Third Culture Kid on the Facebook page, which is hilarious. You should check it out.
Sequoia, I want to thank you so much for being here on the podcast. You are unbelievably awesome. You are an inspiration to other women and people out there to just go, go, go and pursue your dreams and be brave. And I think you're amazing. I wish you the best of luck. Dream of Flight, your book coming out later this year. Where can people look for that?
Yeah, Barnes & Noble's, Amazon. But I would say that I'm a huge supporter and my company's a huge supporter of small local bookshops. So we distribute all across the United States to small and local bookshops. So I highly suggest people choose their local bookshop over any major conglomerate.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for coming in and have a great day.
Thank you. You too. Thanks for having me.
Friends and listeners, if you'd like more information about Sequoia and all the wonderful things she's involved with, you can visit her website at sequoiaschmidt.com. That's sequoiaschmidt.com. And while you're surfing the web, if you'd like more Moonbird in your life, and hey, who wouldn't? Head on over to memoriesofamoonbird.com. Tell all your friends and family to sign up for my email list. And you can also visit me on social media at Memories of a Moonbird. Stay safe.